to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by our friends at Hearst Ranch, www.hearstranch.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. I am Patrick Martins, the host of the Main Course, the new name for our hour from noon to one on Sundays. And I'm really honored to be in the studio with some contacts within the food world who I've worked with for a number of years. We have Chris Jekyll from Morimoto.
Hi, everybody.
And we have Katie Kiefer from Food Arts.
Hi there.
So today we're going to basically divide the show into three parts. The first part is going to talk about swine flu. And then the second part, we're going to talk, you know, in depth with Chris Jekyll about his work at Morimoto and in the cooking world in general. Then we're going to have a famous elder statesman from Florida journalism, Chris Sherman, who's going to come and talk about push carts and swine flu and pickles and scrapple. And then finally, to conclude, we are going to talk with Anthony Falco, who's a pizza man. He's going to talk about pizza history, and it's going to be a first in a series of pizza and hopefully launch into his own show one day. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about this very serious issue. 200 people are sick, 100 in the U.S., and 177 people in Mexico are dead because of H1N1, which actually, Katie, you were saying it's not just a swine flu.
Not at all. They've discovered that it's about six parts swine influenza virus along with one part human influenza, which is what we know as the seasonal influenza, and an avian virus as well. So they haven't been able to determine that it originated from pigs in the first place. So the whole misnomer of swine flu has been very unfair to the pork industry. And you know, could have a big economic impact on our country as well as countries around the world. A lot of countries have banned imports of American pork,
which we're going to cover later. I mean, it shows that American farmers maybe shouldn't be in the hands of rash decisions being made by people who they've never met before, like in Russian.
That's right.
In Egypt, Melissa sent me an article. They killed all their pigs in Egypt.
Well, they started to, but I think they ended the slaughter at some point before they killed all of the pigs. But it was a completely panic-driven gesture on the part of the Egyptian government.
That sounded like a religious thing. Yeah, that was
kind of surprising they even have a pork population, if you really
think about it. Well, that's excellent. So we're going to take a short station break, and then we're going to come with our first guests, Sam Edwards and also Renato Sardo, and then eventually Brian Kenny to shed some light upon their opinions. There's a swine flu is what it had been called. Now it's called H1N1. And to talk about that, we have third generation cure master from Surrey, Virginia, right next to Colonial Williamsburg, Sam Edwards. Thanks for being on again, Sam.
Hey, Patrick.
How's it going over there?
Doing well. Congratulations on the continuing show.
The continuing show. Thank you very much. So tell me, what is the story? What's the word? I mean, your company is 10 miles from Smithfield. What's the word down there? What is this flu, and, you know, how's it affecting the pig world?
Well, from everything I've read in the trade journals and what you can pick up in the media, it's unfortunate they call it the swine flu. I understand why they did it, because it's evolved from the swine flu. But you cannot get sick from eating pork, and but the inference was that you could in the beginning. Therefore, it affected the pork industry really quickly. The market dropped. There were some exports to outside of the U.S., and some of those contracts were dropped temporarily, so that had a detrimental impact on the image of pork at the time. But anyway, since then, the media, I think, has finally got it straight that this has really nothing to do with eating pork whatsoever.
Now, do you think this was like alarmism, you know, created by like environmental groups or organic action groups, you know, just to take this opportunity to attack a hog industry, you know, that does commit many crimes, maybe not this one, but maybe they used it as an excuse to attack the practices of commodity pig farming?
No, I think it was just poor judgment.
Poor judgment. How does it affect you now? Does your pork that you buy, you know, on the marketplace cost less? Or, I mean, how does it affect you? Like, how many pounds of pork do you buy week in and week out?
Somewhere between 15 and 100,000 pounds.
Wow.
And it had some, you know, again, it was very short-lived. I think the pork board and others in the pork industry were proactive in getting in touch with the media about the negative impact that was having on the pork industry by calling it swine flu. And I think it's worked. There's still some people in the media that want to call it swine flu, but I think the general public understands that eating pork does not cause the problem.
So, well, that's interesting. I mean, I, a lot of people are saying what you're saying, and we actually have another caller. I mean, Sam, please stay on, but we have Renato Sardo, who's one of the correspondents, in a way, for many groups, including ours, calling from San Francisco in California. Renato, are you on?
Yes. Good morning, Patrick.
Hey, Renato. I'm sorry to wake you.
Yeah, it's okay.
so tell me, what's the word there? I mean, in the cradle of organic agriculture, Northern California, how has the swine flu been, you know, talked about?
I was listening to the last minutes of the conference. Yeah, more or less, like, we are trying really to, I mean, it doesn't, we are trying to understand if it really comes out from factory farming. It seems so. That's the talk among the community I live in. But it hasn't yet come out clearly from the news. If you read the news, actually, you don't, you know, there is even this attempt to change the name from swine flu to H1N1 has been kind of successful. So it's not, it's still really unclear to the people here and as everywhere else, really, how it really this flu originated. Maybe we don't know yet exactly.
And, I mean, are people starting to eat less pork over there? I mean, is...
Not among my friends, but as far as I know, no. Among, you know, the... What I've seen, people is eating little as before. Of course, I hear the news and I hear that people is eating less pork here, too. But for what I've seen on everyday, you know, life, I haven't noticed big differences.
Now, Renato or Sam, did you read that article in the Huffington Post that talks about like industrial agriculture farms to be very resembling like airports? You know, they're
exactly. No, exactly. That really gives a good. I mean, I have to say that many of the people working in the food. Sustainable in the sustainable food community, if we can call it that way, has called this sort of flu in a long time, and I have read articles similar to the description of the Huffington Post of, like in many times. There was even an article on Science in 2003 that was calling exactly for a swine flu that we have because. The journalist, which is called Bernice Wootrich, I hope I pronounce it well, was really observing that the pig factory are one of the ideal candidates for nurturing really a virus like the one we are seeing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, It's not really a surprise. You have probably discussed it already before, but it's clear that the way we are raising animals is really dangerous for public health concerns. I mean, it's really a way to nurture diseases. That's you know, if you read Michael Pollan, like all the big theme, like they always mention that the public health concern is definitely one of the areas where we should be mostly concerned, and one of the reasons why, you know, industrial food should cost more, because it doesn't take into consideration these kind of costs we're having now.
But Sam, let me ask you, has the big factory farms taken certain steps? I mean, did it used to be worse in the 70s and 80s? I mean, are they reacting to some of these concerns? Sam?
Well, I think some of the concerns about the spread of disease, certainly there, if you go to a commodity farm, you're required to take showers, change clothes. You're walking into an environment that they don't want to bring disease in from the outside. Now, I'm not saying all farms are like that, but and I haven't been on one, so I can't say for certain what it's like. I've only heard from others who have visited. But when you do get a disease in a farm like that, it does spread quickly, there's no doubt. And some of it is brought on by the breed itself, the fact that they're in the close quarters that they're in. They are trying to reduce the exposure, but I think the breed and the conditions that they live in, meaning close quarters, is conducive to the spread of disease if it does get in.
Well, absolutely. Well, this has been a, it's definitely a, I'm looking for a sound effect that can adequately convey the problem. Anyway, that's my favorite one.
Well, actually, that's pretty close because, you know, it is a combination of swine, avian, and human flu. Mm-hmm. The original swine flu has evolved. And was it avian that, evolved to swine or human? No one knows. It's just, a combination of all three. That's what this H1N1 is. It's unfortunate they hung swine flu on the name moniker.
Yeah.
Call it that.
It's too bad. It almost seems like the plague back in the 15th century, 14th century. No one knew what it was. And meanwhile, all along it was these rats, you know? I mean, they would, it kind of seems like there is a lot of mystery. Well, Sam, thank you for being on. You're a sponsor of Heritage and of the radio network and all that. So thank you. And I know you'll be a guest much more often. Renato, if you could stay on, we're going to call in one of your neighbors, Brian Kenny, to continue this issue for one more segment.
Mm-hmm. All right. See ya.
Bye, Sam. Sam's on the phone. Hi, I'm Patrick Martins. This is the main course on the Heritage Radio Network, which is broadcasting out of lovely Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you haven't been there, you should go. And we are talking about H1N1, formerly known as the swine flu. And we have as a guest Renato Sardo. And Katie, I think, did you have a question for Renato?
I had a few questions. Renato, one of the things that we were talking about in the previous segment was about the confined area feeding operations and how those might have an impact on the development of virus strains like H1N1. So just to address kind of how the European model works as opposed to the American model, what kinds of operations do they run primarily in Europe? Because they're big pork producers over there. So, for instance, especially in Spain where they eat a lot of pig. And I was just curious,
Denmark,
like, what's the difference?
Denmark is the biggest producer of pork in the world in terms of density.
Uh-huh. How do they manage their herds?
Yeah, I mean, I think there aren't major differences. The regulations are stricter. And I think that you cannot use drugs. Generally, in Europe, you can use drugs only once you have asked to use for drugs, and you have to demonstrate that some of our animals are sick. While in U.S., it's basically the use of drugs is deregulated, so basically you can add drugs, and that's what's happening.
Oh yeah, they use them prophylactically.
To the part of the diet as a prevention way.
Right.
And that's the main difference. But, you know, I don't know exactly, having said this, I know that also in Europe, like, antibiotics ends up being used, maybe not as much as in the state, but they should check if there is a difference in usage, because I'm not sure of that. That's what generally is said. Then you have to check with the data.
Have European swine populations experienced big outbreaks of disease where the animals are at risk or actually die from disease? I mean, I'm just wondering if, say, Denmark has this dense population of swine growing, swine farming. How do they, I mean, what lessons can we learn from European operations if they're not using antibiotics prophylactically the way we are in this country in commodity farming? What can we do? How can consumers kind of push that needle over to reducing that use of antibiotic and hopefully preventing at the same time disease outbreaks like this? Not that came from pigs. I mean, let's remind people that this particular outbreak has yet to find an American pig that has so-called H1N1.
In terms of big disease, I remember, of course, the foot and mouth one in UK.
Yeah,
that
and they
was
slaughtered millions
of
cattle. You
know, apocalyptic when basically, I don't know how many millions of animals were burned. Definitely there are some diseases also there. It seems to me that the number of these outbreaks is increasing, which all signifies that there are certain mistakes in the system. And in terms of what we could do, well, as consumers, like there are many organizations that now are promoting a better way to feed ourselves, so to go to the farmers market, to buy different stuff. It's surprising me. We should start. There should be someone. I mean, that should start for asking for a more regulation in this industry. It seems that now the moment of the regulation is finally for regulating more businesses is coming, starting from the economy, finance, but definitely also the food business needs that, and definitely we need better regulation and a stronger FDA. That for sure. I'm still surprised that nobody in U.S. raises the issue why the growth hormone aren't forbidden. Most of the beef are grown with hormones, and they are cancerogen. They generate cancer. And why there aren't forbidden? That's to me incredible.
It's actually absolutely incredible.
The lobbies.
Yeah, it's the lobbies.
The packing lobby.
And it's a wrong commodity price. I think the government needs to just set higher prices. Farmers get more money. There's more money in the system, as Renato has correctly said before. Paid for, really, as harsh as this sounds, by the consumer. You know, if farmers could get paid more, you know, the standards would go high. And we actually have another guest. Brian Kenny, are you on?
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Hey, Brian. Brian Kenny is the ranch manager for Hearst Ranch, which is the largest privately owned property in the state of California, and you raise cattle. Would raising commodity pricing, you know, like a forced raise of the commodity pricing, help farmers practice better protocols, Brian?
I don't know that the problem is necessarily the farmers. I think that the problem is where the process is industrialized. So in the case of beef cattle, most cattle are sold as calves to packers. And the packers control the price, essentially, of the calf market. It's done primarily through auction. There are some private treaties that are brokered, but the packers control the price. So there's very little that a calf producer can do to increase their price. Most of the guys that are growing, guys and women that are growing calves, react to the market. So raising the price at the commodity level would do one thing. It would do is it would put a price, kind of a floor for the price of ground beef. But one of the big factors in the beef industry is that when a dairy cow is done milking, she's a depreciated asset and she goes into the beef supply, generally as ground beef, but that puts a false bottom to the market. So I guess the answer is yeah, raising the price would be good, but the issue is more, I mean, packers probably would tend to disagree, but the issue is more that raising, trying to make beef production efficient is difficult. I mean, they're large quadrupeds, and it takes them a while and a lot of feed, 4% of their body weight a day, approximately, to gain. And the hormones and antibiotics are used to increase what's called the feed efficiency, which is one of the major metrics in cattle feeding. And in our grass-fed system, you know, there are two things. There's no confinement, so you don't have the vectors for disease spreading as rapidly. And then secondly, there's just nothing efficient about it. So raising the price would probably help, but the use of the implants is just done. And they call it, they're called implants, the hormones and antibiotics. And it's done just to make the feeding process more efficient. So if you feed 4% of the body weight a day, you want to increase the amount of feed, the amount of weight that you're going to gain because of that.
Well, very, very interesting. I mean, one of the things Heritage Foods does, it tries to promote diversity in the food supply. And certainly if there's viruses going around, flus, knowing you have a diverse food supply, there's safety in that. You know, makes me feel better to know that there's dozens of breeds, you know, some of which might be resistant to a certain novel pathogen. But, well, listen, everyone, thank you so much. I mean, we could talk hours about this, but, you know, we're going to, you know, move on with the show. And thank you, Renato, again, and Brian, for being on. It's an issue that we'll certainly come back to, hopefully, with all of you guys again.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
here we are at the main course at the Heritage Radio Network, and we have as a special guest Chris Jekyll from Morimoto. And
everybody,
thanks for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about, before we get to some of the ideas of traceability and you know, where you guys source from and how important that is to you guys, tell us a little bit about how you came to Morimoto and your history of becoming a chef.
Okay, well, I started cooking in high school. Initially, I spent most of my days with my grandmother after school, so I got raised a little better than I think most American kids did. She had a big garden in the backyard. I ate fresh cucumbers and bell peppers and tomatoes and things, fresh, still warm from the garden. So that kind of started my love for food. You know, I'd come in the morning or in the afternoon and she'd been cooking all day, and house smelled like frying bacon and fresh coffee. And it's just, I remembered those things. So as I got older, I started to cook a little bit at home, and I decided I liked this. So, and I kind of have some ADD, so I didn't really do so well in school, and it kind of lost my attention very quickly. And the kitchen really felt like a home for me. It had a lot going on, kept me going, kept me entertained, those kind of things. So it was a good fit for me.
Where was this?
On Long Island, in Essex County.
Okay.
So once I determined this is what I wanted to do, I went to Johnson & Wales. I got finished Johnson & Wales bachelor's degree, 2000. I started working at an American place with Larry Forgione. Then I moved on to Danny Meyer's Union Square Hospitality Group. I worked at Tabla for several years. I lived in Madison Park for several years. And then I moved to Morimoto, trying to just kind of diversify my background, learn about some new techniques, some new ingredients, things like that. And I've been there since. It's been almost 2 years now.
That's a big jump to go from, you know, Larry Forgione and Danny Meyer and all that to, you know, a Japanese kind of empire. Was that a tough transition for you?
Initially, it was tough. Learning the ingredients and the verbiage and things like that were kind of difficult for me, but it is still cooking. So the techniques and the basics were there, but it took me quite some time to really grasp the ingredients and the methods in terms of how they put things together. It was very different. I kind of joke, the Japanese technique is no technique. A lot of the way is kind of like they put it all in a pot, bring it to a boil, and all the flavors kind of come together. And being trained in the French and the American and the Indian way, there's so many different layerings of flavors and things, where the Japanese are much more singular in terms of their flavor. It all kind of comes together at the same time. So that was probably the hardest thing for me to grasp.
I've heard a lot of people say Japanese cuisine is the most refined of the world's cuisines. It's very interesting that so many of my chef friends have said that about Japanese cooking.
It refined is a way to describe it. But I find that truthfully, I think the French are really the ones that really put the most detail to it. They work the cleanest, they work the most organized. Not to say the Japanese don't, but that's in my experience, been working through the kitchens and things, that the French are a little more. Now the Japanese have a little more aesthetic in terms of presentation, I think. So they have a little more beauty aspects and some more things that maybe don't necessarily add that much to the plate, but add to the experience visually.
And ingredient sourcing must be very different from your previous restaurants to Japanese. Like, I know, don't you import a lot of your things from Japan?
Yes, it's very different for me. So a lot of the Japanese purveyors I actually can't speak to because they only speak Japanese. So, but it's some of it almost scares me a little bit. But the fish comes directly from Japan every Tuesday, every Thursday, every Friday, shipped in sealed boxes from Korean Air. And it's very seasonal. So every week there'll be certain different items in it. Some staples, obviously, hamachi and those type of things you have to have on the menu. That's just, it's people, New Yorkers want to see it. But, you know, baby conch came in this week. Live ebby or white shrimp came in this week. They're in season. So, you know, every week needlefish, those type of things. It just depends on the week. We'll get a different, random different things in. Which is quite entertaining. Another aspect of it for me is the vegetation is the one portion of it that kind of makes me a little uneasy. It all comes in little perfect packages, all perfect size, all perfect ripeness. And for me, I mean, I guess the Japanese way is very methodical. So maybe they really have someone there like perfectly picking each one and packing it, etc. But
they do.
Yeah, I guess they probably do. It's very much sort of their way. But it still makes me a little nervous how it's grown, what goes into it, things along those lines.
I did an article for Food Arts magazine a few years ago, and they had, it was an event at the French Culinary Institute where they invited a group of Japanese chefs to come in, and it was a sort of symposium for the weekend, and there were all these American chefs who were supposed to show up but actually didn't. But it was they did a 3-hour presentation on making rice.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you talk about attention to detail, and also there was a philosophy behind that and behind every dish that they presented that was very different in style and mindset from European or Western style cooking. And I thought that, to me, that was the biggest difference in a way. I mean, from the life of the kitchen in an American or European kitchen and then the life in a Japanese kitchen. I mean, these guys would mentor their young chefs for sometimes their entire careers. And, you know, the kids would sometimes live with the head chef in the kitchen. You know, they would live in their home.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was really, what's that been like for you to kind of, because you must be working with a lot of Japanese guys,
I am working with a bunch of Japanese guys. I actually make the rice now in the mornings.
Oh,
and
no
kidding. That took a long time. Like, they stood over me just to put it in the pot with the water and the proper amount of water to get it cooked. It took a solid month of them kind of like checking me out, making sure I'm doing it right before all right, now we can start cutting the rice and adding the seasonings and things. It took a very long time for them to do that. And they also are very, very methodic in that way. And one of the interesting things about us is the rice gets polished. It comes in brown and gets polished, so it retains a lot of the nutrients and things. So it's also another process that I get to see. I found very good. You know, it holds the nutrients in longer, so it's more healthful for you. Mm-hmm. Most of the dissipation is coming from the outside, the bran and things on the outside before it gets polished. They're very detail-oriented.
And last chef we had was Damian Sansonetti, who was the one Italian in Daniel Boulud's empire, you know, heading up one of his restaurants. Yeah. I mean, can that ever happen with someone like you? Would they ever allow an American to reach the highest level?
It would take a long time. We have one, actually the sous chef at Morimoto now is a white kid.
Okay.
And it took him, he started from the bottom. He's worked at Sumale for a long time. He worked at Bond Street. He worked at Co. So he had a lot of years experience, and he solely does sushi. He does not cook. And he started in Pantry, and it took him, the restaurant's been open about 3 years now. It took him 2.5 years of being mentored. And finally the head Japanese chef left. And it took actually several months before Chef Morimoto would call him the sushi chef. He was better than the rest of the Japanese sushi guys. He proved himself. He worked the head station, the front of the sushi bar, for many months before Morimoto finally said, okay, this is our sushi chef. Finally gave him business cards. It was months of him running the stations before they let him do it.
Awesome. Well, we are going to take a short break and have you come on. I have a few more questions. We have a few more questions. Well, very exciting. This is Patrick Martins, Heritage Radio Network. And this show is called The Main Course. With the Q Report. Oh my God, what am I saying? This is the main course, and we are talking with Chris Jekyll from Morimoto. And one of the questions we wanted to ask you, if you could speak a little bit about the issue of sustainability in fisheries. I mean, I know unlike the foods we sell, which are domestic, many of the foods you sell are wild, and there's constant up and down of where these fish are in terms of population size. So how does Morimoto deal with it?
It is the case. You know, again, in terms of the Japanese fish, it is seasonal. But for things like tuna, which unfortunately you need to have on a sushi menu, it's just the case. So we really try hard to buy fish from different regions and different times of the year. So basically where the population is migrating and things along those lines, we really try and stick with it. So in season, it'll come from the Mediterranean. In season, it'll come from Australian waters. In season, it'll come from Long Island waters. So we really pay a premium for those things to have them. It may be a global market, but we're still only trying to purchase from the areas where the populations are the biggest at that time, mm-hmm. which I think is very important.
How does that work for salmon? I mean, is that always Alaskan salmon?
For us, truthfully, the salmon we buy is farmed. Okay. We buy Scottish. We buy Australian on occasion. That's one of those items where we really think salmon, A, the populations, the wild populations are being depleted greatly. So I think it's more beneficial to buy the farmed items in this regard specifically. It's very difficult to find wild salmon in the West Coast at this time. The populations have been depleted to the point of almost extinction in many categories. So in my personal opinion, it's better if you need to have it, you need to have it on the menu, people want it, it's better to buy an item that's farmed in that case.
Is there a taste difference?
Definitely. The fat content changes, the condition of the fish that comes in, you can generally tell it's been farmed. Whether it's been bruised a little bit more, the flesh is a little off. Sometimes you'll find the tail chewed a little bit or something because there can be tight packing, things like that. You don't see any of that actually with our Japanese shift-in fish. But some of the farm stuff, which is really only the salmon and our hamachi, you do see some noticeable signs.
And if you were the person making all the decisions there, would you source differently? Or let me ask, what would you do differently if Morimoto was your empire, which I'm sure it will be one day, but in the meantime?
If it was my restaurant, I would try and have our servers explain to the customers why we don't have tuna at this point or why we don't have salmon at this point, to really try and stick with it more local or more sustainable in those regards. Even if it's coming from a different region, at least it would be in season in that region and not really coming from being force-fed the items they shouldn't be eating or things along those lines. For me, ideally, but it's difficult in the business world.
And is there an eat local percentage of fruits and vegetables? I mean, is there a component? I mean, does anyone from the Morimoto kitchen go to the farmer's market each morning? Or, is it just a philosophy that just can't do that?
It's difficult. I do the purchasing, so there is items, asparagus is in season, we have asparagus. When it's in season, I buy it locally. Mm-hmm. He keeps it on the menu all year, so when it's not in season, I'm no longer buying it locally. But I pay the premium for it because I'm in control of it. So as long as I keep my numbers in line, no one really questions where I'm getting the items from.
Thank God, because we're a case in point.
It's the truth.
To be honest, already what you do for us just by buying food for your staff is a tremendous crutch for us, and plus you buy the bellies. What do you do with the bellies that you buy from
us? The bellies, we make something called kukuni, which is a region in Japan. It's a classic dish, braised in sake, soy, mirin, and sugar for about 10 hours, and then it gets reglazed in the liquid. It comes served over some scallop-infused congee, which is rice porridge, a little bit of scallion oil, and some crispy gobo on top. It's quite nice.
Awesome. Well, Chris, I hope you come back. It seems like you like Roberta, so I'll see you here one Sunday, and hopefully you'll have your own show one day. Yeah, that would be the best.
That would be good.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you for having me, Patrick. Oh, my God, I'm so hungry.
That's great. I still love you. Regulators. You regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too. But you can't be any geek off the street. Gotta be handy with the steel, if you know what I mean. Earn your keep.
Regulators! Mount up!
It was a clear black night, a clear white moon. Warren G was on the streets, trying to consume some skirts for the E, so I could get some phones. Rolling in my ride, chilling all alone.
Just hit the east side of the LBC, on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweak. All of you search, know what's up with 213.
So I hooked a left on 21 and Lewis, some brothers shooting dice, so I said, let's do this. I jumped out the rock and said, what's up? Some brothers pulled some gas, so I said, I'm stuck.
Since these girls peeping me, I'm gonna glide and swerve. These hookers looking so hard, they straight hit the curve. Want to bigger, better things than some horny tricks. I see my homie and some suckers all in his mix.
I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I can't believe they taking Warren 12. They took my rings, they took my Rolex. I looked at the brother, said, damn, what's next?
They got my homie hemmed up and they all around. Can't none of them see him if they going straight pound for pound. They wanna come up real quick before they start to clown. I best pull out my strap and lay them busters down.
They got guns to my head, I think I'm going down. I can't believe it's happening in my own town.
If I had wings, I would fly. Let me contemplate. I glance in the cut and I see my homie Nate.
16 in the clip and one in the hole. Nate Dogg is about to make some bodies turn cold. Now they dropping and yelling, it's a tad bit late. Nate Dogg and Warren G had to regulate. Explode. Now I'm switching my mind back into freak mode. If you won't skirt, sit back and observe. I just left a gang of those over there on the curb.
Now they got the freaks and that's a known fact. Before I got jacked, I was on the same track. Back up, cause it's on N-A-T-E and me, the woman to the G.
Just like I thought, they were in the same spot. In need of some desperate help. But Nate Dogg and the G-Child were in need of something else. One of them names was sexy as hell. I said, ooh, I like your size. She said my chords broke down and just sing real nice. Would you let me ride? I got a car full of girls and it's going real swell. The next stop is the East Side Motel.
To a whole new era, G-Funk, step to this, I dare ya. Funk, on a whole new level.
The rhythm is the bass. Whoa. And the bass is the treble.
Chords, strings, we brings melody. G-Funk, where rhythm is life, and life is rhythm.
If you know like I know, you don't wanna step to this. It's the G-Funk era, funked out with a gangster twist. If you smoke like I smoke, then you high like every day. And if your ass is up,
you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by our friends at Hearst Ranch. www.hearstranch.com.
Well, here we are at the Heritage Radio Network, which is definitely blowing up. So I am really happy when I heard that my friend, acquaintance, Chris Sherman was going to be in town. I was very, very excited. I've known Chris for almost 10 years. Isn't that right, Chris?
Oh, at least that. I remember the first calls I got from you saying, hey, we're pushing slow food in the U.S. And I said, what?
But you ended up writing about it.
Right. And understanding what it is and loving it.
And tell us, Chris, where are you now? I mean, you're with Florida Trends Magazine, is that correct?
Yes. I write about restaurants and food and wine all over the state of Florida. And then I do some consulting and pursuing the peculiar foods of Tampa, Florida.
Tell us about those, some of those.
Well, we have scacciata, which is the maybe the first pizza in the United States. Hmm. It's a Sicilian flatbread, usually square cut. It's made by a few old bakeries. And the great thing about it is that it's still beloved by everyone in town. If you go to somebody's birthday in Tampa or a football party, they'll bring out a tray of scacciata. Mm-hmm. And you go 20 miles away, nobody knows what it is. Hmm. So that's
very cool. Regional.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the first things we talked about was the regionality of Scrapple, which what is exactly Scrapple?
Well, Scrapple is basically in this country concentrated in Philadelphia. And it's, I guess, a poor man's pate of cornmeal and pork innards, mm-hmm. Various forms of offal and leftover pork. it's prepared into a congealed form, so it sort of looks like a cold meatloaf with a high cereal content. It's served by, or cooked by, you slice it up and then you fry it. And this can be served with or instead of eggs and pancakes, whatever. It's a breakfast meat product, sort of.
So is it kind of cooked like a polenta style? Like then set into a mold and then cooled and sliced?
Like a grilled polenta. And I come from Cincinnati, which is considered porkopolis in American food history. And in Cincinnati, there's another version of this that comes from the German heritage, and it's called Goetta, G-O-E-T-T-A. And Goetta is made with steel-cut oats or other forms of, fairly raw, organic, whole oats and pork, served the same way. But again, you can't get it beyond about 25 miles of Cincinnati. And there are two or three old German butcher operations in northern Kentucky in Covington, which is an old German town, that make it.
Cincinnati's an old... Molly O'Neill is from Cincinnati, right? And her brother Paul O'Neill, my favorite Yankee of all time. And now, were you always interested in these unusual foods? Were you always kind of scouring the country for regional traditions and cuisines?
Well, in Cincinnati, you didn't have to scour. I mean, we had them all. We had our own chili. Cincinnati chili, if no one knows, is...
Very hot, right?
More... well, it is a two-roll-aid chili, but it's...
Two-roll-aid chili.
But it's more Greek than Mexican because it involves chocolate, clove, cinnamon, and cardamom. And then we eat it like it was an Italian spaghetti sauce. And then we add beans, chopped onions, rat cheese, and if that's not enough, oyster crackers.
Could you describe rat cheese, please?
Yeah.
Rat cheese is yellow. I'm not sure there's anything.
We always called me cheddar cheese. I mean, like those old, big old wheels of wax-covered cheddar were called rat cheese when I was growing up.
Right. Only we didn't know from wheels. I mean, these were long logs or...
Oh, really?
Or beams of cheese.
And you serve this over pasta?
Yeah.
It's not served over rice?
Oh, no.
No. Heaven forfend.
Yeah. No, in Cincinnati, it's... It's spaghetti and chili. This is unless you're going a Coney Island route, but spaghetti and chili, and then you add beans, and it's a three-way. Add onions, it's a four-way. Add cheese, it's a five-way.
Oh, I see. So those are options that you can order in the restaurant. You can say, I want it with this, but not that.
Right, right.
Uh-huh.
And,
cool.
And it's one of those great products that many towns have where... You go there at noon, and you'll find everybody. I mean, the suits, the hard hat workers, everybody goes. Coney Island is maybe $1.50, and then up to $4 for a five-way chili with everything.
Wow.
Very, very interesting.
What's the ethnic mix that generated this particular bastardization of good old-fashioned Texas chili?
It's probably German plus Italian plus Greek. And the Greeks really own all of the chili parlors. Cincinnati has probably 100 chili parlors, three brands. In fact, one of the brands has moved to Florida.
That must have made you happy.
Yeah, well, it was
a
long-lost expat Cincinnatian doctor with enough money to say, hey, I'm going to put in Cincinnati
I need
chili.
This on a regular basis. Is it ground meat or beef chunks? That's the other key issue. I mean, as a chili lover myself and a frequent maker of.
Well, it's ground, and let me say, finely ground. Not really? Espresso ground, but almost.
No kidding.
It's a soupy.
Uh-huh. As befitting its covering of pasta.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Well, this is great. We're going to take a short station break, and then we're going to come back with Chris again to talk more about food and unusual foods at that. Chris, that's
Hi, we're back with Chris Sherman, who's talking to us about pushcarts, scrapple, pickles, and mock turtle soup. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and this is the main course. Chris, thanks for coming on today. So we were talking about various regional specialties that are indigenous to Cincinnati, like the famous Cincinnati chili. But you also brought up the fabulous mock turtle soup, which is a significant part of the regional cuisine there, or at least something that has sparked your interest.
Well, anybody in Cincinnati knows mock turtle soup and loves mock turtle soup.
What is mock turtle soup?
Mock turtle soup obviously is not turtle soup.
Exactly.
thank God.
Chris can correct me on this, but the hard-boiled egg is used as sort of a faux turtle meat. So
interesting.
So it's beef, hard-boiled eggs, a tomato and pepper broth, and as an edge, a little vinegar, and I think that's the German touch.
Right, that makes sense.
But it was significant enough that there were not one but two companies in Cincinnati that canned mock turtle soup.
No
kidding. I mean, my mother could make it, but you could also get Worthmore or Stegner's.
Is it still popular?
Yeah.
Yep.
And in fact, Stegner's is now one of the oldest taverns in Cincinnati, and cool. It's probably 120 years old in the Over the Rhine district, not far from Findlay Market, which is one of the great and untold markets in America that has gone on for 150 years and is still there.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And
more of those.
Tell me about, we were going to also talk about like pickles and pushcarts. Are those all Cincinnati-based traditions in particular, or just things that you've...
There are two things that I'm very interested in. Pickles are widespread, but they do have a Cincinnati heritage because they are somewhat German. But in general, the world is full of traditions for taking fresh food and preserving it, whether it's with vinegar, lemon, lime, a salt brine, or a lot of the Asian pickles are made with oil. But I think if you look at kimchi, curtido, all of these are forms of keeping vegetables alive in cold weather.
Sure, absolutely.
And I think it is also one of the great artisan traditions that continues today. And
I think it's enjoying a real resurgence today. There are a lot of restaurant chefs who are starting their own brand of pickles and even selling them in the restaurants.
Right. And if you go to if you're out in the country and you go to a small town produce stand, they may well have Uncle Harry's pickles.
Yeah, that's definitely true in my hometown.
And those are things that I think, you know, have existed before our food revolution and are things that should be supported and survived. And of course, if you go to any state fair, traditionally, you know, pickles are right up there with cakes and pies.
Absolutely. Sure. Blue ribbons. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about push carts? Why is that such a peculiarly Cincinnati-ish tradition?
Well, I think...
What do they sell on them?
Well, in Cincinnati, you would have just your basic hot dog cart or popcorn cart. But I think that's really had an incredible resurgence nationwide. That... Is that... We hit a trend?
I think so.
Push carts and push buttons. No, I think push carts have this wonderfully nostalgic position in the American mind that it's instantly big city. And that translates almost wherever anybody has decided to start a push cart business, that part of what they're selling is being outdoors, meeting other people, being in an urban situation. And this happens even if somebody has bought a push cart and set himself up outside a Home Depot in western Nebraska. Mm-hmm. People feel good about it. And I think that in terms of slow food, this is kind of the ultimate slow restaurant.
Absolutely, and it's a slow restaurant, and it can fan out. You know, you don't need that much infrastructure to serve great street food, which is the, you know, foundation towards all diets throughout history, right? Simple foods prepared well.
And it's also the beginning of food served away from home, whether it's the market lady or the fellow who's working in the city all day, this is the place where he goes to get tamales, or the taxi driver and the shawarma in Manhattan.
I think you're seeing a big resurgence in New York City. You're seeing a lot more taco trucks. You're seeing the waffle truck, even a dessert truck. You're seeing a big portion of those things starting to develop in the city as well.
Including these guys, Roberta's, or Chris Paracchini is going to spend 10 days in Italy to learn gelato making, and then he's going to come back and start two carts, which is a great thing that we're very excited about. But I also remember my hot dog guy was a traditional Sabourette cart. He was really a part of my neighborhood. I grew up on 80th and Madison, and right a block away on Fifth Avenue was this Greek guy named Steve, and he was there, and he was like a set of eyes and ears on the city block, and we could play dodgeball in front of him, and he was a real neighborhood institution, and he was just, you know, hot dog cart.
Yeah, many of these guys were institutions, and in many cases, there are women as well. But the other thing is, it is the one-man restaurant. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy is the maitre d', he's the cook, and he's the stand-up comedian. You know, he does all of these things, and it's... You know, based on everything that he does, I mean, he's in total control. But then the other thing that the push carts do is that it's like the fair or the medieval carnival, is that it brings different tastes and flavors from one place to another. Even if you go to the state fair in Columbus, Ohio, the Italian sausage with peppers, I mean, wow. There was a time when that was where you went to taste new and different foods.
Well, this has been so amazing. I'm so happy you came on. Before you go, I want to know, what is your favorite cart foods of all time? I mean, around the world, what do you like most?
I'd say anticuchos in Peru.
Huh. And tell us about that.
Anticuchos are beef heart in a shish kebab form, and they are roasted on a charcoal grill. They've been marinated and seasoned, not with heavy chili, but with a good spice. And I think that's got to be my all-time favorite, with the another one from Peru, salchipapas.
Hmm.
Have you had salchipapas?
I'm guessing that's a potato dish of some sort.
It's French fries, and then you chop up your basic industrial grade wiener, toss it into the grease.
Ooh, yeah.
Dump it all in a cone, and then squeeze mayonnaise on.
There you go.
Sweet.
Sounds good for you.
Well, this has been absolutely unbelievable. Chris, would you stay on? I know Heather's going to need some help spelling some of these tags that you've given her. Scacciata, goita, and all that. But would you stay on maybe and visit us with the Q report too, in case there are any topics?
Sure.
You're in town from out of town. So this has been the best main dish ever, and also main course ever, and also the first one. So, but we're very excited, and thank you guys so much for coming
on. Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you for having
us. It's a real honor to have you guys. Well, for our final segment of the main course, we have as a guest a certain Anthony Falco, and this is the best sound effect for Anthony. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
I've been eating your pizza for months, and I'm a huge fan. And I actually found out recently, not only are you a great pizzaiolo for Roberta's here, but you're also kind of a historian about pizza.
Yeah, I love pizza, and you know, it's just like anything. I wanted to get some background information on that. You know,
tell us a little bit about what about the history turns you on? I mean, what struck you and got you into it?
My heritage background is Sicilian, and my grandmother, just like any great Italian cook, it all starts with the grandma. And I grew up and eating her pizza and all pizza and just really liked it, and eventually got a chance to go to Naples and have real pizza, and it was mind blowing to know there's something it's so American modern. Actually is rooted, it's, you know, hundreds of years old. Huh. And if you go back to actually just flatbreads baked in that particular kind of oven, I mean, it even goes back thousands of years old.
Really?
The Greeks. Yeah.
So the first pizzas, you could argue, were all the way back in Greek times?
Yeah. Flatbreads cooked in a wood-fired oven with olive oil, herbs, and olives and vegetables, things like that. Would have been pretty recognizable as a pizza to just your everyday pizza connoisseur today.
And what about, when did it start to more resemble the traditional form of like the pizza I'm looking at right here, which I think is the Speckenwolf?
Yeah, well, also tomatoes I think would be the most recognizable thing that came, and that would be the 16th century. The Spanish brought it to southern Italy.
From the Americas, right?
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, one of the many great food contributions that the New World has brought. And it was a cheap ingredient that grew pretty readily around the Mount Vesuvius, and the poor of Naples, it became kind of a staple for them. One of the only things they would eat at all during the winter. Hmm. Marinara was the first like modern pizza that was served in pizzerias, and that was in 1830.
Doesn't that mean marinara, like semen or something like that?
Yeah, like as a fisherman would eat, like you know, there's a trend in like naming dishes after the people who eat them or mm-hmm. prepare them. But yeah, it was like a quick lunch for a fisherman coming on shore, and portable and easy. You can, you know, eat it without any utensils. And that would be just tomato, garlic, oregano, and maybe a little basil and some sea salt.
Tell me a quick story about the queen you were saying. Was it Queen Elizabeth?
Margarita.
Queen Margarita.
Yeah, which is where we get the term margarita pizza from.
That was actually a queen's name, huh? And yeah. What did she ask for a pizza?
She was doing a tour
it?
With King Umberto I, the second king of the recently unified Italy. And he didn't have such a great... he was in need of some good PR, basically, with the people. He had already been... there had already been two assassination attempts on him, which eventually they said would. Not really. It didn't. Eventually they succeeded in Naples, too. But he was doing a tour of the kingdom, and he was in Naples, and a chef, Rafael Esposito, he made a trio of pizzas for the royalty, and her favorite was, which is. You know, she was an astute politician, apparently, herself. She, more than her husband, one could say, she picked the margarita because it had the colors of the Italian flag, green, white, and red. And it instantly became a success amongst the poor working class. Everyone wanted to eat the favorite pizza of the queen. And she was at the same time, though, ridiculed in the courts of Europe for eating.
Or are they sorry they ridiculed her?
Yeah, peasant food.
She's launched probably 70% of my diet, you know, since then.
And her name lives on in pizzerias all over the world.
Well, listen, I would love it, Anthony, if I know how busy you are, come back or, you know, come and do a seminar on the history of pizza, also how to make pizza, you know. I think who better to learn... Then you did you learn here at Roberta's? Is that where you first?
I used to make pizzas with my my dad and my grandmother and stuff, but this is my first professional. Yeah.
Now you're the head guy. You've been there since day one.
Yeah, pretty much from the beginning. Yeah. I like making pizza. It's not a bad not bad work if you can find it.
And we like eating your pizza.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. Yeah, we'll see you again. And that concludes the main course, and we're going to be coming right back with the Q Report.
Hush, oh wildfire, hush, oh band of gold, hush, oh. My love was so true. Hush, my love.